Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Sanofi, we pass the mic to Nicholas James Short, MD, and John L. Reagan, MD, who participated in an OncLive Insights discussion on tumor lysis syndrome. Dr. Short is an assistant professor in the Department of Leukemia in the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Dr. Reagan is an associate professor of medicine at Brown University and the director of hematology at Lifespan Cancer Institute in Providence, Rhode Island. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Short and Reagan discussed risk factors that can contribute to patients' likelihood of developing tumor lysis syndrome, preventive measures for patients most at risk for developing tumor lysis syndrome, and the mechanisms of action and clinical implications of standard treatment options for patients with tumor lysis syndrome.
I'm John Reagan. I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Alpert Medical School of Brown University and director of hematology at Lifespan Cancer Institute, Rhode Island Hospital.
And I'm Nicholas Short from MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. And I specialize predominantly in acute leukemia, so AML and ALL. And so we're here today to talk about tumor lysis syndrome. And so, John, I don't know if you want to start just with a little bit of an overview of what tumor lysis syndrome is.
Essentially, tumor lysis syndrome, if you think about it, is the destruction and release of whatever is within the cell into the bloodstream. So if you think about your regular chemistry panels, your potassium levels are very low, your sodium levels are very high. That's because there's a lot of intracellular potassium. So that's one of the things that we find with tumor lysis syndrome is you just get release of this potassium within the cells. You get release of nucleic acids, you get release of phosphorus, you get release of uric acid also. So anything within the cell gets released out. Problem sometimes with phosphorus is it ends up binding to that calcium and lowers your calcium levels. And that's the real hallmark problem with tumor lysis syndrome is what's inside is suddenly released and brought outside. There's some questions and some other things, some risk factors certainly that happen with tumor lysis syndrome.
So I think also I would say, you know, there are some patients that have what we call spontaneous tumor lysis syndrome. So, you know, in the setting of oftentimes a hematologic malignancy, although not always, so leukemia or lymphoma, they can actually present with these processes already ongoing, right? So the cells are dying maybe because they're rapidly dividing. Tumor lysis syndrome is also something that we sometimes do to patients with our treatment. So we give some therapy, which is a sign in some cases that it's effective, which is good, but these cells then die as a result. So, you know, some of the main risk factors, first of all, are those hematologic malignancies, particularly, you know, leukemias, lymphomas. And in general, the more aggressive you think of the malignancy being, the more likely it is to cause tumor lysis syndrome, right? So the acute leukemias, AML, ALL, those are more likely than the chronic leukemias to cause tumor lysis syndrome in general. And then same for the more aggressive, let's say B-cell lymphoma or particularly Burkitt lymphoma, those are more likely to cause it. Those can all be spontaneous. And of course, when we give treatment, one factor is how sensitive the underlying disease is to the treatments that we're giving. So if we're giving a very effective treatment to a very chemosensitive, you know, leukemia or lymphoma, then that patient may be more likely to develop tumor lysis syndrome. For example, venetoclax in CLL, this is a very effective therapy for CLL. Historically, we didn't, you know, think as much of CLL as causing tumor lysis as some of these more aggressive forms of leukemia, but because venetoclax is so effective in treating CLL, we actually can see that, and that's why there are strategies in place when you're treating a patient with CLL, for example, with venetoclax, to do a very slow ramp up of this. There are other characteristics that can be seen that can be associated with the development of tumor lysis syndrome. If the patient has a very high LDH, this is a sign of rapid cell turnover, so that goes along with the more aggressive malignancies. Those patients with baseline renal dysfunction are more likely to get what we would call like a clinical tumor lysis syndrome and worsening renal dysfunction. We have to be very cognizant of that. In general, it's more common in patients, at least when we give treatment with patients with newly diagnosed disease, because patients with newly diagnosed disease are generally going to be more likely to have chemosensitive disease. Unfortunately, as patients go through treatment, their disease often becomes less sensitive to the treatments that we give, and we actually don't see as much tumor lysis syndrome in those cases. Maybe you want to talk about there's very little evidence, of course, in this space. There's not a lot of studies, but maybe some of the data that can kind of guide some of our practice and some of the preventative measures for patients who might be at risk for development of tumor lysis syndrome.
The key things is keeping that urine output going and doing whatever you can to keep the urine output. The diphosphate binders and using things like either Lokelma or K-Exalate to try to get rid of those potassium if it gets too high. But really the hallmark of TLS treatment is preventing that uric acid from going up too high. The first drug that we always reach for is allopurinol. You know, the mechanism of action, this is all involved in purine catabolism. Purine, if you remember back to, you know, first and second years of medical school, purine goes to hypoxanthine, to xanthine, and then through xanthine oxidase, it gets turned into uric acid. And what allopurinol does is it's a xanthine oxidase inhibitor, so it keeps things at xanthine level. So you're not actually making uric acid. The other drug that's approved is Ruxostat, which is also a xanthine oxidase inhibitor, very, very much the same as allopurinol. We'll talk in a second about how all of those work. Our bodies can't get rid of uric acid. So humans and higher level primates don't have an ability to get rid of uric acid. So what we use is that rasburicase, which is like urate oxidase, which is what converts uric acid to allantoin and helps your body then excrete out the uric acid so we can finally get rid of it. And those are really the hallmark treatments, is giving some sort of allopurinol or febuxostat and rasburicase. Allopurinol goes back to the 1960s when it was first looked at for treatment of really elevated uric acid levels and found to effectively lower uric acid levels. And so that really became that gold standard. Initially, the initial reports for rasburicase came out of pediatric literature. And like with most things with pediatrics, was on a milligram per kilogram basis for dosing. There was a later study by Dr. Cortez out of MD Anderson in Journal of Clinical Oncology. It was randomized, and patients got randomized to either allopurinol plus rasburicase or rasburicase. And that showed that you were able to effectively lower uric acids much better with the addition of rasburicase. So allopurinol was able to lower it a little bit, but rasburicase could really effectively eliminate your uric acid levels. Interestingly, in that study, though, I wasn't able to find anything in terms of renal replacement therapy and the need for that renal replacement therapy. So that's always something to kind of think about in the back of your mind. And then Spina et al. In Annals of Oncology in 2015 did allopurinol versus febuxostat. And with this study, they showed that there was really no tremendous difference in terms of uric acid levels. So once again, randomized study, but no tremendous difference in terms of uric acid levels in these patients. And I think that's the big take home. There was maybe some signs of cardiac issues with the febuxostat population when they get treated. But I think the big issue and the reason that we don't usually use this drug is because of the cost. It's an order of magnitude higher in terms of cost to our clinical pharmacists, who are so essential in terms of helping us treat tumor lysis syndrome. I usually shy away from this drug and really help us in terms of allopurinol dosing and what's effective dosing for those patients. So these, you know, allopurinol, I think, and rasburicase are probably our most used drugs for this. Could you outline any of the clinical implications of prophylaxis and kind of those treatment options within it, when you would do it, when you wouldn't do treatment for prophylaxis?
Yeah, I guess we can just think about some of the particular considerations that we have. And I think one of the big questions always is the IV fluids and the allopurinol are pretty clear, right? For anyone who is kind of intermediate or high risk of tumor lysis. We're not always sure is when should we be using rasburicase, right? So considerations for rasburicase, this drug is very good at kind of rapidly reducing uric acid levels. So typically within 4 hours, you can get a significant reduction of uric acid just after one dose. And actually one dose is often adequate for many patients, although certainly there are patients with very aggressive, bulky tumors, rapid turnover, where you might need to redose, right? You might need to redose more than once. But in many cases, actually, in my experience, you know, one dose of rasburicase may be all a patient needs to get them out of kind of the danger zone where you're worried about clinical tumor lysis syndrome. Other considerations when we're thinking about giving rasburicase, for example, is it's very important after a patient has had rasburicase to accurately measure the uric acid. You need to measure it on ice, so the sample should be transported on ice, because if it's not, the rasburicase will continue to dissolve like the uric acid in the sample and you'll get a falsely low read. So these are just some kind of clinical things to think about when you are treating a patient with rasburicase. In general, well-tolerated drug, but hypersensitivity reactions can occur, so you need to be aware of those. I think one of the main things to be aware of when giving a patient rasburicase is that you can see severe hemolysis in patients with G6PD deficiency. That said, oftentimes, as I mentioned, tumor lysis syndrome is an oncologic emergency, and we often don't have time to test for this, and we often don't know, of course, G6PD status on the majority of our patients. So when you're in that situation where a patient urgently needs to get the uric acid down, don't stop to test for this. But certainly if a patient has a known diagnosis of G6PD deficiency, you would not want to use Respiracase because of the risk for hemolysis. In thinking about who might be higher risk, G6PD deficiency of note is higher in those with ancestry from Africa, Asia, Mediterranean, or the Middle East. So you might have a little more of a suspicion in those patients, and you need to be extra careful, of course, watching all of these patients. But I think the key thing is, at the very least, if you don't have G6PD status before giving Respiracase, at least remember that hemolysis is a potential complication. But if you start to see worsening anemia in the patients after the dose, you at least immediately think of this as a potential option and then treat accordingly. Now, as far as when do we actually give the Respiracase prophylactically? So, you know, usually based on the studies that you had mentioned, a lot of institutions have adopted a cutoff of around 7.5 milligrams of uric acid as kind of a threshold, but it's not exactly just the uric acid in and of itself, right? So for example, there are patients who have chronic kidney disease or other causes of hyperuricemia who have elevated uric acid. It doesn't mean we should be giving Respiracase to those patients. So the way at least we have it on our formulary and the way that we practice, you know, clinically, is we consider the level of the uric acid. So again, a cutoff of 7.5 is often helpful. And then for those patients, even who have a uric acid of 7.5 or higher, they have to have at least two other risk factors to justify giving the Respiracase. And also, this goes along with, do I really think that this is related to tumor lysis syndrome, or could it just be from something else, right? So those would include patients who have an elevated serum creatinine, those patients who have a very high white count, it's like 50,000 or higher, for example, elevated LDH, or they have underlying what we would call high-risk disease. And like we mentioned those, like a very aggressive B-cell lymphoma or a aggressive, you know, acute leukemia. Now, even for those patients who have lower uric acid levels below 7.5, we still do consider it prophylactically, even for those patients, if they have multiple of those risk factors. So if I have a patient with, again, Burkitt leukemia or lymphoma that has an elevated LDH and a high white count, and their uric acid is 7, I'm still definitely going to give that patient Respiracase before I start treatment, because I'm almost certain that that patient's going to develop tumor lysis syndrome if I don't. I think other considerations for Respiracase, for example, I think it's important to think about. So interestingly, allopurinol and Respiracase, even though they're both used for prevention of tumor lysis syndrome, they actually can be a little antagonistic, at least theoretically. So allopurinol can actually interfere with Respiracase activity. So if possible, we like to give Respiracase first if we're planning to do that, and then start the allopurinol afterwards. Now, this is not always feasible, unfortunately. If you have a patient come in, they may have already been on allopurinol, or they're started on allopurinol as prevention, and then they start to develop tumor lysis syndrome. We often then just add the Respiracase on top of it, but acknowledging that that may not be as effective as if you give the Respiracase in someone who hasn't been exposed to allopurinol. So ideally, you give Respiracase and then start the allopurinol afterwards. And then I think, you know, in thinking about doing all these management, hopefully we can manage all these electrolyte abnormalities and other issues, but sometimes it does come down to getting our nephrology colleagues involved. The next step after giving, you know, hydration, allopurinol, Respiracase, the measures that we discussed earlier, sometimes dialysis is really the only thing that's going to clear out those electrolytes, protect the kidneys, or support the kidneys through this event, and it's really just supportive care. But we typically only reserve this for patients after all our other supportive care measures that I mentioned have not worked.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Sanofi. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State and Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.